All right. Well, you guys, we're wrapping up at least this section of chapter 19, verses 1 through 15. We've called it Matthew Kingdom Design. And on that second slide, Matthew 19 is about kingdom design for community. And the community, because chapter 18 was about the church community, and what we're talking about here in this community is the nuclear family. And so this passage was mainly about marriage, divorce, adultery, and all those things. But we felt like it was time for us to really take the implications of this passage and push it a little bit farther. And so in this biblical design for marriage and family, these were the things we tried to touch on, or at least felt like we needed to touch on. First was the sanctity of marriage itself. Second, the inadequate nature of same-sex marriage, the disruptive nature of divorce, the destructive nature of extramarital sex, the erosive nature of premarital sex, the corrosive nature of pornography, the distortive nature of homosexuality, the dysphoric nature of transgenderism, the appreciation and respect for singleness, Jesus brought that up in this, and the sanctity of children. So these were things we all wanted to touch on, and somewhere in there, all of us can relate, right? Let's not act like I'm separate from this. I can relate to places in here more than others, but it touches all of our lives. Now, the sanctity of marriage itself, which I think is really important, here, let me just give you a definition for it. It is a God-established, purposeful, special union between a man and a woman to build and to share a life together. It is a covenant relationship marked by the highest order of commitment, companionship, growth, fidelity, sexual intimacy, and love. So that's a biblical definition of the sanctity of marriage from which we're really basing all that we're talking about on, okay? Now, this biblical design for marriage and family has been targeted in our culture. We all feel it. We all see it. We all think it. We all experience it. It has been targeted to be destroyed. So, now, I have just a couple of paradigms I want to make sure we have in place in order to address what I'd like to address today. So the first one we've gone over several times. If there's nothing else that you carry out of this series, I hope this goes with you. In fact, I have it even printed up on some sheets of paper over here that are, so if you want to grab it on the way out, there's some packets over there in those packets. But it's this one. There's three guidelines for a dialogue filled with integrity and compassion. We live in a culture where we're going to have to dialogue about these things. And so how do we do that with integrity and compassion? Here are the three pieces, truth and grace. Just like Jesus in John 1:14, it says that he was full of grace and truth. We want to be full of grace and truth because grace without truth is not necessary, right? If there's no truth, then there's no need for grace. It's just all whatever. But grace without truth is not necessary, but truth without grace is harsh. It's kind of mean. If Jesus was full of grace and truth all the time, we want to be full of grace and truth. Secondly, there is no room for dehumanizing, devaluing, degrading, demeaning anybody, anytime, any place, anyhow. No place for it. Jesus said, if you set his thumb on Raca, you stupid, worthless piece of trash, you're worthy of the fires of hell. Pretty strong, right? He says, man, you degrade that which I made and made in my image. You degrade it. And I'm not happy, right? Third, we are not the judge at the end of the day. But God is. And we will face him as our judge. We will, every one of us, me too. He's going to look me eyeball to eyeball and say, Kevin, what'd you do with your life? And he'll go, well, you really know. He goes, yeah, I do know. And that's why I sent my son to die for you. Because some of what you did, I couldn't excuse. And I gave my son for you. Wow. But we're going to face him as our judge. So that's an important piece. You guys, I have one other paradigm I want to throw out there that's really important, I think, for today and I think for our lives. And it's really this. It's a holistic biblical sex. Okay? So holistic, that means the parts add up to the whole, right? Holistic, that's what that means. And here are the parts that add up to the whole of what sex is all about biblically, okay? First of all, it's very relational, obviously. But we live in a world where it's become less relational. One night stands, you know, just let's hook up. You know, it's become so unrelational. It's become something else. But it's relational. There's a oneness to it. And that's what, isn't it, God called us to, is a oneness. And really the Greek word that might relate to that is phileo. There are four Greek words for love, three of which are in the New Testament. Phileo is one of them. It's an interpersonal friendship. You see, sex wasn't just about a physical thing. It was about a person and a person, about a oneness, about a uniqueness to that, and all that happens in that. And there are all sorts of incredible physiological things that happen in the midst of sex that are all about bonding and connecting as a human being. It's amazing. Phileo. The second thing about sex that you have to be ready to be responsible for if you're going to participate in sex is the fact that it's procreational, right? I mean, that's the only way it happens unless it's artificial. But it's procreational. It's to be fruitful and multiply. And the Greek word that's kind of a familial affection, the Greek word is storge. It's not in the New Testament. But storge is this family love. Isn't there something unique about family? There's just something that's so profoundly, God created this thing called family. To be, have this relational, familial affection for each other. For Di and I, you see him once in a while, we have our grandson here a lot. I tell you what, I get such a kick out of that little dude. You know, he's just such a delight. Now, I don't have to discipline him. That's mom and dad's job. You know, I'm grandpa. You know, I'm tied is what he calls me. And so I just get to be tied. And like when he needs to be, you know, disciplined, I just kind of shove him off to Tori and Brad, you know, like, hey, do your thing. But I love this connection of family. Well, the third piece of sex is it's recreational. It's all about pleasure. It's not all about pleasure. It's part about pleasure. The Greek word is eros, which we get erotic. Now, sex isn't supposed to be just erotic, but it was designed to be fun. It was designed to be physically pleasurable. But real biblical sex, and I want to change the word. I want to go to holistic biblical sex. Holistic means these. It is the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Because when we get the holistic, it includes the Greek word agape, which means this divinely unconditional love. And so sex was designed to be relational, procreational, and recreational all at one time, and you're supposed to take responsibility for the whole thing all the time when you do it. And when you tear those pieces apart, you begin to degrade what sex was supposed to be all about. It's being responsible for all of it. So, you know, we have this great debate about abortion in our country. But you know what? We could stop it tomorrow. If every guy in America said, I understand the responsibility that I carry when I'm sexually intimate, and I am not ready to take responsibility for the procreative piece, and I don't want to take sex and destroy it into pieces, and therefore, I'll not be intimate with you. That'd be the right thing to do, wouldn't it? Say, no, I buy into a holistic view of sex, and I can't do this because I'm not ready to be a dad. Period. Love you. I'm going home. Right? We could stop it tomorrow, guys. If men took responsibility for what it is. Holistic sex. Now, you guys, today, I want to talk about a biblical design for marriage and family. I want to touch on these two things. The distortive nature of homosexuality and the dysphoric nature of transgenderism. Now, some of you said, you're out of your mind, Kevin, to touch on these things. And you guys, I might be, but here's the deal. Our culture is being torn apart right down the middle on these issues, right? You guys, almost every major denomination in our country is being torn right down the middle on these issues. Now, I am grateful that the Evangelical Free Church of America is not being torn down the middle on these issues. I don't want Quest to be torn down the middle on this issue. So in that sense, I don't know if I want to do this. But in a bigger sense, I do not want to leave you uninformed. I do not want to act like it doesn't matter. I want to address these things. So I'm really glad to be here to address them. My only concern is that what I say would be fair and it would be compassionate, and that what you hear would be what I say. So we'll try to jump into that and touch on it all, okay? So just to kind of review where we've been. So in this thing that God created, and this has kind of been our, let's go to that next one. This is kind of that diagram that I've used, that we were created in His image, male and female. He created us, and that He created us, on this next slide, that it's not good for man to be alone, so God made a helper for him, and so there's man and woman, male and female, okay? And then on the right side of the screen, that we were made for oneness. We weren't made to be alone, we were made to be one. And so there is this beautifulness of male and female being put together. Now, in Romans, it says that His will is both good, acceptable, and perfect, even in the area of His design for sex. It was good, acceptable, and absolutely perfect. Like, wow. But in Genesis 3, it got all messed up. Man, you see, woman was deceived, and she questioned the veracity of God, and man was passive, and he didn't take his responsibility. And there was this incredible fracture that happened. And we know in that story that both Adam and Eve began to cover up, right? They took fig leaves and covered up their private parts, and they began to hide from each other. They began to hurl insults at each other and blame at each other. They began to hurt one another. And they built this wall between them. And then even the breakdown in our own culture of male and female, it all gets broken down. And then we end up in this place where sin ruins everything. Even the most critical things of our lives is area of sexuality. So to see this humanity, you guys, this is another piece I think is really important. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I feel like it's profoundly important. When we look up here and we say, our humanity, it's our identity. Identity is so incredibly important. And our humanity is what identifies us, made in the image of God. That's the most important thing. But one of the things that we fall into is to begin to look at our identity as, look on this one, maybe gay and lesbian. You guys, I wrestle with this in my own family. I've told you that my son identifies as gay. And I've been around the gay community enough to know some of the problem is they begin to see that as the umbrella of who they are. Everything's filtered through gay or lesbian rather than just their humanity. See, gay and lesbian may be on the foundation on which you stand, whether it's a foundation that's solid or not is an issue, but they begin to see everything through that. And when we buy into that, then we begin to see them as only gay or lesbian rather than human. Their humanity. See, we have to totally reject that and say, no, I'm going to see you as a human being. I'm not going to label you this as if it defines everything about you. Or even on the next slide, the issue of transgenderism, say, that defines you. And inside my heart, I say, no, it doesn't define you. What defines you is you're human, and you have value, and you're important, and you're made in the image of God, and God loves you. And you have tremendous value simply because you're a human being. You don't see me, oh, he's a heterosexual. You see me as a person. That's what I want to be seen as, a human being. We need to do the same thing. Let's just see him through the filter of God, not the filter of culture, okay? So, you guys, when it comes to homosexuality and transgenderism, our culture reflects a growing abandonment of what I call natural law. That's what philosophers and theologians have always called it. Natural law. Here's what it means. Natural law means an observable law that relates to either natural phenomena, right? There are certain things. Stephen Hawking, in his book, A Brief History of Time, identifies four fundamental things in natural law that govern everything. One is gravitation. The second is electromagnetism. And then strong interactions and weak interactions, which are atomic level issues. He saw everything relating to those four. You know, it's interesting, gravity, right? We all relate to it every day. It's a given, isn't it? I mean, you don't just go jump off the top of a 10-story building and think the gravity's not going to work. Of course it works. Do you know that if we took all the planets and stars and everything out of the universe and only left the Earth, and we took a football out to the edge of the universe, that the gravity of the Earth would pull it in eventually. It's amazing. Gravity works. There are certain things that you can't escape. Well, the second law of natural law is that it is a body of unchanging moral principles regarded as a basis for all human conduct. But we have rejected natural law as a culture. As a world, increasingly, we have rejected rationalism. We've rejected what is really true, the way it's designed, like gravity. You guys, probably, there are all these passages that deal with homosexuality. Probably the most important is Romans. And I'm going to go there really quickly. But I want you to see a key word. Look at this in Romans 1, verses 18 through 32. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. And in these things, in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." It's every one of us. "For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened," where they forget that God is God, where they've forgotten that they've forgotten that there is a God. Then verse 22, "Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things and mainly themselves. But therefore God gave them over to the lusts of their heart, to impurity, for the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." Now here's the key one. Look for the word natural. What is in nature? What is of natural law? Or what is of a given? "For this reason God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations, the way things were designed, for those who were contrary to nature. And that men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty of their error." You see, God's natural design was for a man and a woman. They were built for each other. They're totally the same and totally different, so they could be complementary. That's how God designed it. Look at this in verse 28. "And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, they gave themselves up to a debased mind and to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They were full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, maliciousness. They were gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents." Whoa. "Foolish, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. And though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things will deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them." I think it describes our world, our culture. That's kind of it's not natural. Now, this transgender issue, there's not a ton in the scriptures that address it directly. It's a little bit of a more modern phenomena that's been brought on by the ability, not only social emotionally, but medically, to do something about. That's not always been true. But I think there are some things we could still relate to. And however, it's God's design, though, in Genesis that we still keep as our reference point. That's our reference point. And beyond that, nothing should be affirmed. And so we ought to Also, we ought to understand the various dynamics that are going on in our culture. You see, what's going on in our culture is simple, but it's not simplistic. Okay? So I'm going to run through some things here on a circle just to help you think through some issues in our day. Okay? So I'm going to put a circle up here, transgenderism. I'm going to add the first one. It's this, that we no longer live in a Christendom culture. We are post-Christian in our culture now. If you take God out of the middle of the culture in your worldview, if you take him out, it creates a vacuum. And a vacuum is always going to be filled by something. If you take him out, then what is going to fill that? It's going to be other things. It's going to be worldly things, a worldly way of seeing things. We live in a post-Christian culture. Secondly, you guys, the search for identity is both normal but also magnified in an individualistic post-Christian culture. You see, the most important thing that a person does between 1 and 20 especially is to establish identity, figuring out who they are. It's natural. It's normal. It's developmental. It's what happens, right? Personally, I remember as a young person, I don't remember exactly the years. I think I was probably 9, 10. And I began to struggle internally with wondering if I would ever have what it took to be a man. I watched men. I had my dad and all sorts of other people. And I thought, wow, will I ever have what it takes to become that? Right? So the most important thing a dad can say to his son along the way is, you've got what it takes. You've got what it takes. You've got what it takes to be a man. And you go inside, you go, really? Well, he says I do. So you begin to develop into that. You've got what it takes. If you tell a person you don't have what it takes, then it sends them into an identity crisis. It's normal, but it's magnified in this individualism of our culture. What you think or what you feel is all that matters. The culture around you cannot inform you of that. Now, it does, and they begin to follow it in a sense, but this developmental process is really important. And we have kind of messed that up, I think. Secondly, the next thought. Your identity can often be marred and scarred by the traumas of life. Understanding who you are is affected by things that happen to you. Probably the worst of all, and we'll talk about it in a minute, is sexual abuse. And it can mar and scar people deeply. Hard to get out of it. Another thought. This is really, I think, important. There is significant evidence that resilience has declined in young people. Psychologists and educators have been talking about this for several decades now. The ability of resilience to stand up to the difficulties of life. It's almost an internal toughness that failure or other people being against you doesn't wipe you out, but the ability to be resilient. The rates of anxiety and depression have gone through the roof as people have struggled with being resilient. This is an important piece, I think, of the developmental process of young people. And when we say that when they become not resilient, then they bow to the pressures and the problems of the world. Here's another thought. I think stereotypes of male and female can unfortunately be way too narrow. They can be too narrow. I'm just going to show some guy stuff. I'm not going to show girl stuff, but here's some guy thoughts. For me growing up, what was the stereotype? It was John Wayne, right? Hey, you know, the guy was studly muddly, right? Or for a little bit after that, Jean-Claude Van Damme. He was amazing, right? Or James Bond. You know, that's what it means to be a man. Or more recently, Hemsworth, Thor. I was talking to someone earlier today, they go, oh, he's a good-looking dude, you know? I'm like, yeah, he is, you know? But when he puts on the Thor outfit, he's like, yeah! Or an F-6 World War II fighter plane. This past week, I went with Jason over to a retirement center over here, and there's a guy over there who flew F-6 fighter plane in World War II in the South Pacific. And I tell you what, you meet the guy, and you just go, oh, my gosh, he is a stud. This dude is a stud, you know. But you know what? Not every guy is John Wayne, Claude Van Damme. Some are more creative. There's all like that. But they're still men. You know, but we have too narrow. And I put a bunch of gal stuff up here, but it'd be way too much flesh for the ideal that we create for women. No one can live up to. It's crazy. So I think the stereotypes can be way too hard. Here's another thought. What the medical world can do, they sometimes ought not to do. They can do all sorts of things, but they're not all right. Many times some people have accused them of being money-oriented in order to make Okay, make that. And we see this blowing up all over our country right now. Part of it, even right here in St. Louis, with WashU, on what they've been involving young people, minors, and what they can do. Here's another thought kind of connected to that. Puberty blockers, hormone therapy, and reassignment surgery actually can't change the biological gender of a person. Every gal is Stell. Every cell in her body is XX. Every cell in my body is XY. You can't change that with these things. I'm afraid that many times that we're beginning to see people after these kinds of procedures find themselves in as much depression or more than they were before. And it's scary. Here's another thought that kind of adds into all this. Authority and responsibility for children has been transferred from parents to institutions. And God made the parent responsible. Let's be good parents. It's not easy being a parent. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. But we have transferred the authority to institutions, schools, medical places. It's not their responsibility or authority. It's a parent. And I think we can get sucked into this. Here's another thought. Parents can live in tremendous fear that if they don't align with their children, that their children might do something destructive. Right? Of course. And that's kind of the culture now. Because we now live in a culture where, well, self-care is now really self-harm. And we're afraid of people doing self-harm, and so we say, if I don't align, then I'm probably going to drive them to do something bad. That's really real. I don't know about you. You could feel that, right? And yet maybe it doesn't really help them to simply agree, simply to help them feel better. But they don't have much resilience, and they have a hard time recovering. Here's the truth of it, though. 80% of all kids who struggle with transgender, by the time they end puberty, will have worked their way through that. 80%. 94% of all people who struggle with transgender temptations, by the time they're 21, they've worked their way through it. But it takes some work, takes some time. It's hard. Last thing. We live in a world where there is an epidemic of loneliness. And to deal with that pain of loneliness, in our culture, an 800% increase in people dealing with transgender temptation in the last few years. 800%. It is not a biological issue. It is a social, emotional, psychological issue that they're struggling with. And we need to understand it and care about what's going on. So, what do we do with all this? We live in this place of great fracturedness of our humanity. And it doesn't go away with this medical procedure or that. The fracturedness is still there. The hiding is still there. The walls we develop are still there. So I think the thought is this, that whatever violates God's original design ultimately violates not only God, but it violates ourselves and it violates each other. When we violate him, we violate everybody. Whether it's extramarital sex, premarital sex, divorce, transgenderism, same-sex marriage, pornography, homosexuality, the whole brokenness. And it doesn't just, we're not just talking about two issues today. We're talking about all of us today. So I think the first thing that we need to do is this, is compassion for the turmoil that people go through as a result of the tragic disruption and impact of sin, even in our sexual lives. Now, I'd like to illustrate you guys, but I'm going to illustrate this in a way that no speaker ought to ever illustrate. So just so you know, what I'm about to do should never be done again, okay? And it's going to, so just know this is not the way to end a sermon. This is not the way to do it, but I'm going to do it. Because I ran into this, a friend of mine turned me on to this book called Inside Out by Larry Crabb. This was written 35 years ago. You'd think, well, that's old. But here's the deal. The real change is possible if you're willing to start from the inside out. This, I think, has profoundness for us. So you guys, I'm going to read quite a bit here. So track with me if you can. But I think it's really important. But don't ever do this. If you ever speak, don't ever do this. And don't tell anybody I did it. Okay? But listen to this. This is incredible stuff. So I'm going to try to give it some oomph to keep you awake. With the loss of joyful freedom to fully express all that we are as men and women, that's pre-fall, Genesis 1 and 2, right? With the loss of that, now we get into the rest of it. We sense a deep uneasiness, a restlessness that drives us to recapture the wholeness that comes from enjoying our sexual identity. But without God, the nearest we can come to rich and exciting enjoyment of that identity is fulfillment of our physical desires. It's the closest we can come. Sexual excitement and climax provides fallen people with the closest available approximation to what it means to be fully alive as sexual beings. What was intended as an expression of our sexuality has become the evidence, even the substance of it. Something vital as life, as human beings, has been lost. We no longer begin with a quiet confidence of our intactness as men and as women. We're not certain our masculinity or feminine souls have the resources to remain alive no matter what failure or rejection comes our way. A sense of substance as men and women is simply no longer there. We feel driven to recover it. And because we're desperate to regain what we know should be there but isn't, we feel irresistibly drawn to sexual pleasures. The experience of physical excitement and fulfillment gives us a few happy moments that make us feel alive as men and women. Sexual pleasures are compulsively attractive precisely because we no longer see ourselves as truly male or truly female. And when we doubt our essential identity as men and women, we struggle. A person without an awareness of masculine or feminine intactness lodged deeply in his or her soul cannot live according to God's design. You guys, listen to this one. The problem is threatened sexuality and an inevitable consequence of moving away from God. The symptom of the problem is sinful sexual expression. The function of the symptom is to provide a counterfeit, momentary sense of maleness or femaleness, and that too is sinful. When people turn from God, the first thing that they pursue when God removes his restraining hand is sexual pleasure. Soon they reflect their damaged identity by perverting their sexual desires. Springing from the root of threatened identity as men and women, people engage in all kinds of sinful practices that corrupt their relational style. Larry Crabb writes, I wonder if the energy with which we pursue sin grows out of our threat, out of the threat, the fall introduced to our identity as male and female. If that's true, and I think it is, then an inside look that gets to the bottom of things will expose our doubts about our ability to function as men and women. Until we sense that deep discomfort we feel in relating as men and women, we haven't touched the core of our struggle. The primitive threat that's always present in fallen people, that's us, the legacy of our first parents, Adam and Eve, makes boys, you guys listen to this, the primitive threat that's always present in the fallen people makes boys aware of their weakness, their incompetence, and helplessness. As they sense an importance to enter their world with strength, they learn to compensate by emphasizing whatever special abilities or talents they discover in themselves, or they generate a counterfeit sense of masculinity through aggression, rebellion, and exaggerated independence. Or they retreat into passivity that wimpishly demands that someone take care of them. Girls quickly feel violated and unsafe. Even the most caring parent will occasionally fail to come through with an appropriate loving response. But little girls learn that their survival depends on tucking away that wonderful part of themselves that was designed to give vulnerability. And when someone wins a girl's trust to the point where she risks exposing that deeply feminine desire of vulnerability and then betrays her trust, especially sexual abuse, which is the worst form of betrayal, she comes to regard those desires within her as reason for shame and self-disgust. At the very center of our soul, we feel shame and fear that is attracted to our identity, that is attached to our identity as male and female. Yes, there couldn't be a statement more true than that one in today's world. Males lack the healthy confidence that they're intact men who can move into their world unafraid of being completely destroyed by failure or disrespect. Females lack their quietly exhilarating awareness that they're secure women who can embrace their world with no worry of having their essential identity crushed by someone's abuse or rejection. You guys, thank you for surviving that. But I think those words are so powerful. In fact, probably hard to maintain. So I have some packets over here with that quote that you can take home with you and wrestle with. So what do we do? The second thing I think we need to do is be courageous to rebuild God's design for our relationships, even in our search for meaning, even in the area of our sexual lives. I'd like to just finish with this one thought. Jeremiah chapter 2. And I think it describes what we in our culture in large part have done. In Jeremiah 2, it says this, verse 12, "Be appalled, O heavens, at this. O universe, at this. All that we see, be appalled at this. Be shocked. Be utterly desolate, declares the Lord. For my people have committed two evils," he says. "For they have forsaken me, the fountain of real living water." You turn away from God, there's no more water that's living. It's all stagnant. "You have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewn out cisterns for yourselves. But unfortunately, they are broken cisterns that can't hold water. Even stagnant water, but especially living water." And I think we live in a culture that has said, "God, I don't need you anymore, and I'll do it my way." But the cisterns are broken. My prayer, my hope, is that we would be compassionate for the people around us, but give them hope, and that God would move in the midst of all that we're doing as nuclear families to build those and make them strong. You guys, thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for letting us address these difficult things. We're trying to pull together some resources to help you understand these issues deeper and longer and broader and wider. We'll let you know when we get those. We're evaluating some right now because this 45 minutes was not enough. But no word says we don't care and we have no opinion. I do care and we do have an opinion. But hopefully it was one that was worth hearing. So you guys, thank you for this. I think we're going to finish with a doxology. Okay? So you guys, why don't you stand and join us. Let's worship together.